I think this idea that technology is going to be a fix for whatever the human problems are, we're going to find a technological solution. That is very much in the sort of thought world today, in the zeitgeist. And it's got a kind of credibility. It seems plausible. You know, why not? What's wrong with it?
Hello. Welcome to the Keswick Convention podcast. I'm back with James Carey. How are you doing, Jam?
Honestly, I'm recovering from a sore throat that's lasted about 3 weeks. And they said, you know, the advice is go and see a doctor if it's been that long. But it's just started to get better and I don't sound too gravelly. So we'll see how we go.
I'm glad we've got you in some level of one piece.
Mm. And I tell you what, I'm really looking forward to this episode because we've just, in the previous three, opened so many cans of worms. And there are just kind of worms everywhere. Yeah, but I think these are worms that our society is desperately trying to get their hands on and wanting answers to. So this is a really exciting journey. So I'm really excited to check in on the conversations that you've been having. We've got John Wyatt coming up and, you know, you started a great chat with him. So I want to hear more from him and from Roz Clark as well. So let's get to it.
Yeah, well, I'll let your former self take away with your chat with Matthew Mason. He's the Christian Ethics Tutor and Director of Crosslands Cultivate. Let's have a listen.
So let's go right back to the very, very beginning. We're told and we know that we were made in God's image, and we've heard that so many times, it's almost lost its meaning. What do you understand by the term being made in God's image?
We need to say a number of things about the image of God. The first thing is to say it just means being like God, that actually we are created to reflect him in the world. And so in Genesis 1, we're created to rule over the world just as he created it and rules it. We are to rule under him. In Salisbury Cathedral, near where I live, there is this incredible font that is just beautiful. But one of the beautiful things about it is that it's got this absolutely glassy, reflective surface. And you can look into the font and see the roof of the cathedral reflected in the font. So you can either look up and see the roof of the cathedral in all its majesty, or you can look in the font and see the reflection. That's what we're designed to be. We're designed actually to, so that we can look at one another and see the beauty and holiness and righteousness of God, his love, his wisdom reflected in one another.
I've been to that font. I've been to Salisbury Cathedral recently on a tour, and the tour guide takes great delight in saying that that glassiness is so convincing that he's seen somebody put a camera on it thinking that it was a glass top table, and The camera did not last long.
I have seen someone put a handbag in there.
The water wins every time, doesn't it?
Every time.
Yeah. But it's so interesting that that's where we start, because again, our humanness and our own sense maybe even of worthlessness, and we talk about being made in God's image, we still somehow keep thinking about ourselves rather than what God is like. How have we got there? That seems like a very strange thing, given that we live in such an age of narcissism, that we still can't quite get our heads around being in God's image, can we?
No. Well, I think once you lose sight of God, you lose sight of how brilliant humans are. That we sometimes think that if we make a big deal about God, somehow we're going to actually diminish and shrink humans. But I think the reverse is absolutely the case, because we're God's image bearers. Yeah. That actually the bigger and more enticing our understanding and our knowledge of God is, actually the more glorious men and women and boys and girls are going to seem. And the more we think God is really great, the more dignity and worth and value humans will
have. The 20th century is an utter demonstration of that, isn't it? We're thinking of, there are 3, 4, 5 different regimes which systematically destroyed religion and our image bearingness. Yeah. And the number of people that were executed, enslaved, rounded up, destroyed, go into the hundreds of millions. And it's interesting that that we'd lost our image, that God had gone. Isn't that extraordinary? We think it would be freeing, but actually it's horrifying, isn't it?
Yeah, it is horrifying, because in the end, I think either, because what happens in the late 19th and through the 20th century is, instead of being in the image of God, more and more we're just thought of as being another kind of animal. And so we're going to diminish ourselves. And now I think we're just often thought of on analogy with machines. So we're just biological machines. And that's about as diminished as you can be compared to where we were created to be. Crowned with glory and honor is how Psalm 8 puts it.
So, I mean, but the thing is, the conservative evangelical in me is already worried that we're pumping up our tires a bit too much here and going to be turning ourselves into narcissists. Is that so bad after all? Maybe we do have too low an opinion of ourselves.
Yeah, I think we do. And I, you know, the greater we're supposed to be, the more dignity and beauty and nobility and power we're given in creation, the more serious rejecting that is. I think it actually, far from reducing the sinfulness of sin, I think the higher our view of humanity within, you know, a biblical framework, the more we go, wow, sin is really serious, because look at what it is we're degrading and trying to destroy.
So I guess there's a difference between self-esteem and a right understanding of being an image bearer of God. I guess I've answered my own question there by the way saying self-esteem. I mean, that's probably part of it, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. In one sense, Genesis 1 and Genesis 3, I've been thinking about this a little bit recently and going, you know, God says in Genesis 1, you will be like me. Satan says in Genesis 3, you can be like God. I think we get ourselves in a tangle because we think in the Satan Genesis 3 sin kind of, let's replace God, let's take his place, let's be like him, but without him. And actually what we then do, as we've just been discussing, is we diminish ourselves and we make a dreadful mess of life in the world. But there's a right way of being like God where we reflect his perfect character that then sets us free to really. And so we just have to keep these things together. We can't just do Genesis 1 theology because we are sinners in a fallen world, but we can't just do Genesis 3 theology because that's not where the story starts and it's not where it ends either.
Yeah.
God became a man in order to restore us to our true selves.
Again, going back to our evangelism, how can we make this a message of good news to those around us? I mean, because I guess, again, we may be conscious that we're offering a gospel of self-esteem. But actually, maybe people really do feel demoralized, that they are no better than animals and that this is good news. You know, again, is maybe this is the gospel that we should be explaining.
Well, I think it is. And for a few reasons. Firstly, because the fact that we want to say people are really important, people are really valuable, is actually a Christian conviction. And you can't really believe that without the Bible. And what you have is what one theologian calls, in the end, if you get rid of God and you want to say humans are really important and you worry when humans are diminished or degraded, all you have are cries of alarm. There's no actual reason for it. I'm just upset about this. So that would be one thing. And another thing would be to say, if in the end, one of the reasons we're so obsessed with my own self-worth and my own self-esteem is because I have to get it from somewhere. I have to get it from somewhere. And so I have to generate it in myself. And I have to recruit a lot of other people who are going to say to me, Matthew, you're really important and significant and you're way better than you think you are. And don't beat yourself up and don't be so hard on yourself. Well, what if we were to say, actually, we can give you really solid ground here. There is a God who loves you, who made you in his image to reflect his goodness and his beauty, who came to redeem you so that actually the way we all mess up and let ourselves down and let other people down and most of all offend against God can be totally dealt with. So actually it becomes, in the grand scheme of your life, that the failures become insignificant. And what matters is that you are loved and that you are made for God.
For some reason I've got in my head the prisoner. And I don't remember watching The Prisoner. It was this rather curious TV series, wasn't it? But the great line from that is him saying, "I am not a number." He's sort of been dehumanized and living on his own. But I guess we've all been in situations where we've been given a number and we haven't liked it. It's rather dehumanizing, isn't it? And actually, this is really good news. We are not numbers. We are not a series of DNA, genome. I remember back, you know, in the 80s or 90s, the thing doing the rounds was, here is the chemical makeup of a human body.
Yeah.
You have enough fat for 100 bars of soap and enough iron for a 9-inch nail and all that kind of stuff. And it was meant to make us think that we are more than that. But I don't think we've really fully embraced that, have we?
No, I don't think we have. This is a sort of tangential thought that you can discard or retrofit. But I worry that in our churches sometimes we do this kind of diminishing thing of, in the end, what we're after is a bunch of cookie cutter clones who match up to someone's ideal of what a Christian ought to be, rather than being willing just to embrace. I was with a group of people the other week, and I was just like, I looked around the room and went, there are eight of us and we're all just a little bit odd. and it's wonderful. We are quirky, and all of us were comfortable in our quirkiness. And so everybody had their own kind of texture or flavor or whatever it was. And it was just wonderful to see the interactions of these really distinctive people that was just enriching and lovely and beautiful. And so I sort of long for, in my own life, to be able to affirm that in other people, and in church life to go, we're all followers of Jesus, but we're all totally different from each other as well. And that's great. That's not something to diminish, but something to embrace and encourage.
I guess as Christians in the church, we think that this cookie cutter thing is a problem out in the world, that everyone's struggling for some identity. But hey, come to us in the church and you'll be able to find out who you really are. And yet we do provide a series of stereotypes for people to try to fulfill, and we don't embrace the weirdness and the oddity and the fact that God has made us all slightly different, but actually we do conform, don't we?
Oh, totally. Yeah, we all end up wearing the same clothes, speaking with the same accent, watching the same television programs. And I'm just like, I more and more just want to rebel against that and go, do you know what? God made me a little bit off center and I'm okay with that.
Yeah, that's really helpful.
Huge thanks to Jam and Matthew for that. Hold on to your hat though, a handbrake turn is coming up from an encouragement that we don't need to feel that we all need to wear the same clothes to Keswick Convention this year, and to be reminded that we matter as we are, more than a number, and we are loved by and made by God. But we're going to jump back into a conversation we started with Professor John Wyatt next. Are we good enough as we are as humans? We're going to pick up on where we got to a few weeks ago, thinking about a form of transhumanism that is potentially impacting us now, and what we should think about cosmetic surgery or less intense ways of transforming ourselves. Do you think there is anything we could take from the transhumanism ideas as Christians that would be helpful for us? And maybe would you help us understand what your understanding of transhumanism is and how we could take some of that and benefit from it?
So transhumanism is a philosophy which basically says, why do we have to be satisfied with humanity as it currently is, with the Mark I original model, Homo sapiens? Why don't we use technology to actually improve our abilities in whatever we choose? I mean, we're free, we've got these bodies, why don't we do better? And that might be kind of some kind of physical enhancement in terms of our appearance, in terms of our sporting ability. It might be our mental abilities. We might be able to make ourselves more intelligent. We might be able to manipulate our moods. And this is certainly an idea whose time has arrived. It's been around for a long time, but up till now, the technology really wasn't up to it. Whereas now, we have really powerful technology. And in fact, a kind of low-tech transhumanism is already here. So in many ways, cosmetic surgery is a kind of version of of transhumanism. You know, I don't like my body as it is. I want to improve my appearance. I want to, you know, get rid of the fat or have bigger breasts or, you know, I mean, amazingly, apparently genital cosmetic surgery is now a huge business. A lot of this, tragically, is to do with porn and the ubiquity of porn, particularly for young people. And now I've got to sort of modify my body to meet the standards that I'm seeing in the porn industry. So this idea has already arrived, but I think it's going to become more and more significant. I mean, people are talking about drugs which will improve my cognitive function, drugs which can erase unpleasant memories, drugs which can and actually making a link between the human brain and computers, so I can link up with computers. And one of the most interesting and bizarre ideas is what's now called moral enhancement. So there is already some evidence that with particular chemicals, you can make people be more pro-social, less aggressive, less more sharing and generous. And so this is the idea, you know, there's so much unrest, there's so much polarization in society, we're going to use technology as a fix to make better people. And there's even so one of the writers writing about this said, you know, if we ever get this new technology for moral enhancement and it's safe and it's effective, then we're going to have to make it compulsory. Because you can guarantee that there are going to be some people out there who are going to be refused this, and those are the really bad people. And so the really bad people are going to have to be compelled to have this moral enhancement. I think this idea that technology is going to be a fix for whatever the human problems are, we're going to find a technological solution. That is very much in the sort of thought world today, in the zeitgeist. And it's got a kind of credibility. It seems plausible. You know, why not? What's wrong with it? Personally, I feel deeply worried about this idea that we're going to make our bodies better, because surely the Christian understanding is that our goal is to become not better humans in a kind of functional way, but better humans in the sense of being more like Jesus, that to be fully human in the sense that Jesus was. And maybe in the future, we're going to have to say something like, you know what, if this kind of old-fashioned humanity was good enough for Jesus, then it's good enough for me. I don't need to develop this new enhanced kind of humanity. But the other thing is that I do wonder whether this deep longing there is in so many hearts that says, there must be something better than this. This, you know, my mind dreams, I have all these wonderful visions of what could be, and then I wake up and it's Monday morning and my body is tired and I'm saying, is this all there is? And so I do wonder whether that is, you know, there's that wonderful verse in Ecclesiastes that says that God has put eternity into human hearts, and whether this is a kind of inconsolable longing that C.S. Lewis called it, a longing for the new heaven and the new earth, for a redeemed humanity. And the route to that is not through technology, but is through death and resurrection.
Do you think there's ways in which we can taste that now with makeup or physical exercise or brain stimulating things? Or, I mean, I'm here with I've got borderline plastic cosmetic surgery for a droopy eyelid or a congenital bilateral ptosis, if people want to get technical about it. So how do you think as Christians we can approach that kind of thing?
It's a really interesting and difficult question, isn't it? But I think conceptually there's a difference between what I would call restoring the masterpiece, you know, this idea that we're all unique masterpieces created by God, and we're all of us in some way flawed and imperfect and damaged by all kinds of ways, and using advanced technology to restore the masterpiece back to the way that humanity was meant to be is one thing. Using technology to make a better, to actually enhance the masterpiece, I think is different. And interestingly, I think there is a kind of analogy here with art restorers. I mean, people working in the National Gallery and places like that. Interestingly, they also have a code of ethics. And their code of ethics is that you should only use technology according to the original artist's intention. And therefore, if you're restoring a, you know, a wonderful portrait by Rembrandt, what you've got to try and do is uncover using, you know, X-ray and all kinds of other means, uncover what Rembrandt really intended to do, and then use the technology so that eventually it looks as Rembrandt intended it to look. And so in the same way, perhaps we should use everything we know about the way that God has made us as humans so that we can restore ourselves as much as possible to what God intended us to be, but not to actually change the design.
Thanks to John for his thoughts. I really think it's interesting to think of ourselves as masterpieces and then working to restore them with kind of the owner's manual in hand, as it were. We're going to drop in briefly to a conversation that I almost had off mic with Ros Clark. She's the Associate Director of Church Society and the author of the Keswick Convention book this year, Human, Made and Remade in the Image of God. We were talking about being authentically ourselves in the new creation and what that might look like. And following another discussion about my corrective eye surgery, she then threw this into the mix.
In the new creation, what your face will look like, I think, is a really interesting one as well, isn't it? Because at one level, you could say that's a defect and therefore it will be put right. But another level, it's just who you are and it'll be perfected. And will it be like Jesus's scars that will be glorified?
Wow.
And we'll all be looking at that and celebrating that asymmetry. I don't know. I genuinely don't know, but I'm really curious.
I've never thought of that, you know. I've always assumed it would be corrected, inverted commas. But what an interesting thought. Oh, wow.
And I mean, certainly we will be able to recognise you.
I'll probably still be Ginger.
Whatever changes happen or don't happen, well, you know, you'll still be you. It's very interesting to me talking to people with different kinds of disabilities, how strongly some people feel about not having that corrected and other people being corrected. And I genuinely don't know what will happen.
Any starters for 10?
The Lord knows. Well, I do think something about Jesus' scars is a helpful place to start. And I think, again, I think there's a difference between somebody who was born and then had some kind of accident or illness that left them disabled and somebody who was born disabled. I think whatever there is will be something glorious. So perhaps if deaf people are still deaf, it'll be wonderful because we'll all be speaking sign language. Maybe. I don't know. But it will all be wonderful. So there's that. Mm. The lame will run and the blind will see. So maybe that will all be fixed. Mm.
Wow, more cans of worms being opened there. And I guess we're just going to have to get hold of the Keswick Convention book, Human, Made and Remade in the Image of God by Ros Clark, because she's really thought about this. So lots more there. But we're going to move on and talk to Ben Cooper, Deputy Director of the Cornhill Training Course, and Rachel kicks us off.
That if you're trying your best, then your best is kind of considered perfect. If you could only shout at your children, then that was the best you could do, and that's as good as it can be. What do we think about ourselves and the people that we're in relationship with when our best isn't our best and our best is actually our worst?
I think the first thing to say is we shouldn't be satisfied with that. And I think, you know, the scriptures would encourage us not to be satisfied with that state of affairs. So we continue to struggle with instincts within ourselves and desires within ourselves and all sorts of things that cause trouble in those sorts of situations. So I guess key to that example is you're faced with a situation that doesn't go quite the way you want it to. And still your first instinct is to react with anger when you should be reacting with love or patience or whatever. So you've got an instinct within you that's not quite right. And we shouldn't be satisfied with that. We should want to change that. And I think, you know, the encouragement of the scriptures is indeed to change that sort of puts us back on track of, again, going, you know, what it means to be human and living out a life that is truly human. Now, how should we think about ourselves in those situations? I mean, there are various wrong ways we could go in a situation like that. One would be the complacency. So that's the thing I guess we just talked about. One would be sort of to catastrophize it and say, well, I've failed again. What a complete disaster. There is no hope anymore. Woe is me. That kind of catastrophizing the moment. But if we're Christian, the great thing we can do is we can turn to our relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ in that moment, and that being the thing that we can kind of refocus on. So in Romans 6, for example, it's really interesting. Romans, and there's lots of sort of kind of very deep theology in Romans, of course, as we know. And just as Paul's sort of outlining that to us, that there'll be some moments where he'll suddenly pause and give a command, you know. So he may have been sort of relating some amazing theology in particular. So in Romans 6, he's relating this amazing theology about our union with Christ, our connection to Christ, and how we participate in everything that Christ has done. But there's just a moment in chapter 6 where he gives a command, and the command is about our identity. And the command is to consider yourself connected to Christ. This is how you should think about yourself: connected to Christ, connected to his death, connected to his resurrection, connected to his future. Consider yourself, therefore, dead to sin and alive to God and in Christ Jesus. You know, so that's, if you like, that's his pastoral advice in a situation like that. How should I think about myself? Or I should think about myself, not focusing on the sin as the heart of my identity, but now focusing on Christ as the heart of my identity. And actually, that's the place from which I can start to do battle with these things. I can start to put some of these things to death, because I can start to see just how inconsistent they are with who I really am now in Christ. So those kinds of things are what comes to mind when you give that example.
How do you personally enjoy being an image bearer of God as you kind of sit down to your daily work? What kind of thoughts go through your head? What do you reflect on, or what would you like to reflect on?
Well, I think I'd have to admit that I find it a struggle. My tendency going into a day is to panic, usually, and to probably think all the wrong thoughts about myself and about what the day holds, and probably to think that if the worst could happen, then probably it will. You know, those kinds of fairly pessimistic thoughts. You know, so I do have a tendency to pessimism. I mean, I used to defend this, actually. I think, you know, in some ways it's, you know, I'd say that, oh, it's better to be realistic about it than being, you know, looking at everything through rose-coloured spectacles. But however, it's in many ways a false way of going into a day. And I'm having to relearn a bit more positivity. Not just sort of forcing myself to pretend that everything's going to be fine, but by remembering who God is, what God has done, who Christ is, all of those kinds of things. And personally, I find that the Psalms enormously helpful in this regard. So I've made it my practice. So I think this is quite a turning point in my Christian life when I made it my practice to either be reading a whole psalm or to be thinking about part of a psalm and trying to do that as a daily thing. And I find that an enormously helpful reorientation to some of the realities of life. You know, things are not as they seem, and we need to be reminded how they really are. And the psalmists are, you know, are just so good at helping us with that. And they'll begin it, often begin a psalm, I don't think it, Psalm 77, for example, you begin a psalm in a state of anxiety or despair. And the encouragement there is to actually pour that out before God. And as you do that, you could start to, you know, reformulate a sort of proper perspective on things. Remember who God is. Remember his promises. Remember his presence. All of those things that you can remember. And that is, it might not immediately kind of lift your mood to new heights, although often it does, but it will be enough to sort of go into the day with a sort of fighting chance of getting through it. I personally find it actually quite hard to go into a day feeling really joyful about what's going to happen. And so it's a struggle for me. It's something I have to actually put a bit of work into. You know, I have had to sort of form some new habits to make sure that I'm continually reminding myself about some of the truths that I know that I'm convinced about, but just need reminding about all the time.
If someone needs reminding as they listen today, what would be a psalm that would be your go-to?
What I've found reading through the psalms is that they all, you know, it's great. You can pretty dip into any of the psalms, but yeah, Psalm 77, as I just mentioned, I think is a brilliant one because it takes you from that state of lament and despair, but then a reminder what God is like, and it ends on a note of praise. And in fact, I think that's probably the dynamic across the Psalms as a whole. You know, on the whole, you know, the balance of Psalms that are lament Psalms, you get more of them at the beginning of the Book of Psalms, although you do get them all the way through. And that the note of praise and confidence gradually increases. Although it's, you know, it's not simplistic. It, you know, it's quite complicated. There are various psalms that I love, but I also find sort of intriguing and frustrating as well. So Psalm 131, which is a very short psalm, it's one of the psalms of ascent, and it's where David is commenting on the fact that he's put aside thoughts that are inappropriate for him as a creature. It goes back to the idea, I guess, sort of him remembering that he's human and not lifting himself above being human. And he talks about the fact that he has calmed and quieted his soul, and it's like a weaned child with its mother. Instead of being kind of anxious and grasping at things, he's now kind of properly calmed down because he's sort of settled who he is and he's put his hope in the right place and those kinds of things. And I find that enormously kind of intriguing. I find it frustrating in the sense that David doesn't really say a huge amount about how he did this. You know, I'd love him to say much more about that, but nonetheless, as an encouragement to do that, I find that enormously helpful.
Wow, that's a really helpful note to end on with Psalms. Yes, the Daily Prayer app, which I use, that's the upside of being an Anglican. Although they don't check, anyone can use it. You get at least a psalm a day, and there's an audio bit as well, where today they actually sung it, and it sounded great. And it really feels like we're rediscovering the Psalms as a vital source of encouragement and refreshment, something that we actually need. because you don't just need your five portions of fruit or veg a day, you need a psalm as well. What do you reckon, Rachel?
Love it. I've recently come off a Christian holiday where we looked at Psalms 145 to 150 and about praising the Lord and how good it is for us when we do. And it's so overtly there, and it's so good for us when we are, as a human, in line with what it means to be made in God's image and living that out. I feel we've just covered so much ground in this episode. I was really struck by Roz's comment about my eye. I feel like everyone's going to be looking at me if people come up to me at the Keswick Convention to see if they can see the asymmetry and offer their opinion on whether or not I have it in the new creation. I'm fascinated by that. And again, John Wyatt's thoughts on maybe just being able to see where culture's going with the dissatisfaction of our own bodies and not necessarily going on with that transhumanistic way of thinking, but enjoying looking after, living in and restoring our bodies with that owner's manual in hand. So that's been something I've been encouraged by. Anything else that you want to take away into the next week, Jam?
Well, there's just so much to talk about. And here's the exciting thing. Have the conversation in person at the Keswick Convention, because that is the theme of this convention. So there'll be loads of stuff on this, and all of the people that we've spoken to in these podcasts will be there on either week one, two or three. I said either there. You can't have either one, two or three. But anyway, one, two or three. But go and have a look at the website, keswickministries.org, and find out which week you can get along to and get booking your accommodation. And it's going to be great.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll speak to you next time.
Cheerio.
Bye. That'll do.
Yeah, that passes for a conversation. Yes, that couldn't have been recreated by a chatbot, I don't think.
I like it.
If you're enjoying this podcast, be sure to check out the other Keswick Ministries resources freely available for you and your church online. Catch up on Keswick Convention talks through our Kes Talks podcast. Download study guides for small groups based on convention seminars. Browse books and daily devotionals, and much more by visiting keswickministries.org.